be on.
No, fine. I was wondering maybe while we have lunch, we could listen to the 20-minute audio collage that I've done of the four 1984 dinners. I tried to splice some of the audio together as if they were eating together from these different parts of the world. 20 minutes. So we don't have to listen to it all. We can just eat and listen. Is that all right?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Yeah.
Jeff Brooks.
Oh, they are fantastic. Corn. Organic.
Some cheese.
Has everybody got some food?
Oh, no, thanks.
Okay, thank you. It's all organic.
It's amazing.
I pay my respects to the elders and
us, the elders, we have work to do.
But I don't know, I'm a bit ambivalent about it, because part of me thinks that knowing this history is very important, you know. But part of me is wondering also, is it better for younger generations
to know? To be a burden.
Yeah, you know. You inherit that fear, but then can you process that fear to something else? That's a good question.
We are the ones who failed, I think. We failed after the whole new South Africa thing. We forgot that there were those in South Africa that didn't have the experience that we had of being outside of we just came in and then we got involved with positions and money and this and that and that, and we did not share with our communities. That's why we have today problems of xenophobia.
When I look back at the 80s and all these things happening, on the more positive side, actually, we should take pride, those of us involved in theatre, that it was good that theatre got into trouble. And we were the only one getting into trouble. We were the only people talking back to the state. You look at trade unions, so definitely not. They're all society, they went a small way. Academia was not, and academia is supposed to be, you know, the vanguard of intellectual history. Media wasn't. It was theatre in a small way, a very small group of people, very nascent, but then so weak for little resources, and we always get into trouble. All the other censorship battles that was fought by you all, and later into the early 90s.
Yeah. When you asked us whether we have political, what the connection is between politics and art, I mean, I guess by saying everything we did was political, I don't see what Robin thinks about this. I don't necessarily see that meaning, that as meaning everything, that there was a political message, but that we then went, you know, how can we apply our art to it?
Yeah.
But that, by saying everything was political, was not to say that, was not to say we only dealt with political issues in the news, but it was that we saw every move we made as whatever we were, artists or what,
at all,
as being inherently political, just as everybody else's moves were inherently political, which is basically saying we saw politics in everything and therefore thought of everything as that we did as being political. Nevertheless, we were obsessive about the art.
Well, yeah.
in our powerlessness, where once we, because of interaction and support of one another, that we have some sort of influence and a sort of power. Producing big things.
Yes.
Literally.
It's a good title for a book, A Sort of Power.
Yeah. How wrong we were to think we were going to change the world. But at that point, there was a sense of having some sort of power.
I think 84, or looking at the 80s, we were caught in a time when there was definitely a promise of change in the air. And then that's why some of you and you were kind of like, you could do things or it was naturally of that generation. But on the other hand, there were old security agencies and old mindsets still prevailing.
I think that we lost that idealist edge, you know, in many ways, because we were so focused on fighting an authoritarian regime, or what we thought was an undemocratic regime, when really the threat was somewhere else.
After the founding of the U.S. community, when a great number of us South Africans who were there formed an art organization called PITO. PITO meaning a gathering. And the idea was that all South African artists who were in Africa, who were then in London, to come together and form this organization to look after themselves and, of course, to continue this. This program of the poetry for liberation, theater for liberation, things like that. And then that organization called PISO has been successful at its founding day, but it didn't last long because political organizations wanted it to belong to them. That is the problem. The BCMA wanted us to belong to them, and they had also AEC, and we said, no, we wanted an independent artist group. We didn't see why we should belong to any political group. We can do so as individuals, but not as an organization.
I used to hate, we used to get asked to perform a lot, you know, by political groups, and you knew they didn't really care at all about what we did, but they thought they should have some colour movement. And it was really insulting. We were, you know, whacked on somewhere whenever the really important speeches were in and did a bit of fix that.
I always remember when my dad was talking about what Lucien said, you know, which is, you know, during revolution, politicians and artists work together, and then when victory comes, politicians will start suppressing artists. So should we all just sit still? So no matter which party, you know.
I mean, you know, the GLC, you didn't need to bite their hand, really. You know, that they were actually on the same side. And I suppose you always play games with funders, but the games I have to play now are ridiculous.
So the fame in 82, Jamshami Theatre Company was able to go by invitation to the Cultural Resistance Festival in Botswana. This was a very major event, very exciting for a young theatre company with a non-national cast making a play called Marabi, driving in a yellow combi, like coming out of 1968, across the border, being stopped by the security police and looked at with, you know, deep sort of suspicion, but nevertheless allowed across the border to a festival that was clearly, although, you know, we know more now than we were then, run by the ANC in exile in relation to their project in Botswana, Medu. And I suppose we also know now that the reason we were allowed to go across the border is because this was actually part of the beginnings of a set of secret negotiations, which is, you know, it's easy to say that now. But the ANC and the apartheid state were actually in the beginnings of a conversation. And we were part of that conversation, although we didn't understand it, just the fact that we were allowed to go. Again, really, a kind of research on the tension in that festival between ANC type perspective and black conscious perspective. Because a lot of the, for example, the leadership in the theatre community were actually black consciousness.
It would seem that in the 80s, when funding was not a drama, it's an instrument to control theatre. Yeah. They use internal security measures.
Yeah.
But nowadays, our policy is no longer very politically useful to use those internal security measures. Mm-hmm. So then, by that, they have funding as a very powerful weapon to everybody play.
Yeah.
So that's both the more sophisticated, the rule and the curse of getting money from the state.
Organisations and individuals now, a huge number of them, see themselves as being so dependent on arts funding that they are unprepared to be openly critical of the ways in which that funding is distributed. Far more now scared to do that than they used to be.
Get fucking angry, and I have always got angry. I just think I'll punch the walls unless I do something that's creative and say.
I really broke it.
In our communities, because I grew up in quite an affluent community, people would say to me, "Why are you getting involved? It's not your problem. Get out. Stop it. You're causing trouble. Don't cause trouble in our space." And this was, you know, parents would say this, or they would tell their kids to go away, not to hang out with us. Or family members would say, we're not visiting that house because, you know, they're crazy at that house. So it was a very difficult period. And also, remember, the state of emergency started, so you had to, three people made a crowd, so you had to be careful about where you walk, who you were with, who you were seen with. I think very fondly of Lake Rosa Adam, who was probably, you know, stalwart in the women's movement, and a lot of that awakening was in the way that we would go out as youngsters, you know, we'd go to parties, but they were always very specific. It was always a very particular narrative, a dialogue, and community of people that you were interacting with, because politically you were educating yourself.
No, my anger and my motivation, every time, because as a child, every time they said you can't because you're Aboriginal, I took it to mean that you were trying to stop me because I was angry, so I get angry and do it anyway.
That movement was fueled by what I call a fire. It was a fire of apartheid, and it was very clear, and a very clear enemy, except that the basic point was that we lived in a social crisis. And my understanding and what I tried to do with the market was accept, and that's almost like a celebration. Let us celebrate our new social crisis. Because we have one. My God, we've got a social crisis.
Oh, here we go. I've got a mixed platter here. So we can.
What's the other one?
Our tofu.
I think that there is a way in which the work that was made from the 60s through to the 80s has been. What's the word? Made provincial by the establishment. So, does that make sense when I say that? In order to kind of pull the rug from it. Yes.
I sometimes get the feeling that we've been kind of duped by the. I mean, the kind of idealism that marked the work at that stage and then subsequently that characterized the work at TNS and that affected, I think that really was a part of what Uncle stood for. Mm-hmm. Kind of idealist, humanist philosophy of politics, I think. Somehow we didn't see the fact that that it was not just raw power that you were, you know. I think the PAP obviously was the sharp edge of the spear, but behind it was this whole capitalist mechanism.
I think we worked our socks off, and actually there were other forces at work. So I don't think we were unsuccessful, but actually there were other forces, and you know.
But we don't have to take on board the question about fracturing that happened.
Yeah.
You know, and the fracturing that happened in terms of, you know, if we're able to talk about a groundswell of bringing people together, you've also got to talk about, well, is that sustainable? And if it is sustainable, how is it sustainable? And in a way, we weren't really thinking about how that might be sustainable when we were all in these very awkward defensive positions in relation to each other. We weren't coming together.
Apartheid and the period I grew up is the most normal thing I ever knew. Now, there was love, there was strangeness, there was bar mitzvahs, there were many, many normal things going on.
My crime, even though I say I'm little foot sick, you're just putting up a very innocuous place. They say that the place themselves are innocent. They say,
yeah, she said that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Because I told them that no ministry of education is not an arts festival fringe, or why is it subversive? They say, okay. They say the arts people didn't know better. Alright? They didn't know the people behind controlling me. That we were used. Okay? To put up plays to cause some unrest. So on the surface, plays like Esperanza about foreign domestic workers, they are fine, but the motive behind is to make people dissatisfied. And all this is done without even me knowing.
One of the things we were always talking about was empowerment, getting empowerment happening. And one of the collisions that we had in our workshop was in fact that our brief was, when we were making posters, was that the people who made the posters. And eventually that got to be seen to be quite stupid, because the people didn't want to make the posters, they wanted us to make the posters.
5 or 6, I was all discussed in theatre and political activism at heart. And my passion was to destroy all vestiges of what was called community art, because community art to me meant, and usually was at that time, with the exception of your work, of course, which I acquired. I always wanted to be in the Pratt Factory, and I always thought it was great what you guys were doing, the circus also, and that. Community art meant to be really bad art. Just everyone was unrehearsed, poorly paid, and I definitely was great.
I mean, we never mentioned the C word in the 90s. I mean, I would be getting invited to talk about community arts, you know, like Confiscate keynote speaks for community arts somewhere, and I'd say, I just don't use this term. You know, it's too dangerous. That, you know, it's not so dangerous now because nobody really gives it a second thought, you know. But in the 90s, you were just a bad mural artist if you were a community artist. And so you called it anything. And, you know, public art, called it, you know, whatever. But I was just always surprised that in other places that it was actually quite valued as a term. But I was very wary of it.
Community arts. I grew up not unlike Owen Kelly in the belief that community arts was in fact radical arts. It was mad people doing crazy shit. That's what. And it really was only at the point of going, hang on a minute, all communities, whoever they are, whatever they are, have a right to create their own voices, to make their own voices heard, and that it should be the job of government to create situations in which that is possible.
I do think I should be funded to change the world, because I think I've got something to offer, not with the most ridiculous strings attached.
This is from a restaurant called Bismillah up the road here. Yeah,
delicious.
They're very good.
We always felt, even when we had lots of government money, that we had nothing to lose. So that if we didn't like what either the government was doing or what the funding authorities were doing, we would say so publicly and loudly over and over and over again. More often than not, we would lose the argument, and more often than not, we knew we would lose the argument. But it was worth having, and we would have it over and over again. And what I've noticed now is that is not happening.
Ironically, I think even political criticism, dissent became a style. You could dissent in a certain way. I mean, you could have a dinner theatre where you would you can make fun of the PAP, and you know the PAP cadres were there, you can't be there. How do you get that critical distance? How do you get that, you know, at the edge, the radical? How do you find that edge again? I think that's what we've lost, you know.
This is my first time having the opportunity of talking to all of you.
Yeah, actually, first time we've had a chance to talk to you.
Because, yeah, you know, actually, you all have been too silent for too long.
Yeah.
The situation is very good that their function is to come up and
yes.
Shut it on top of the building.
But what I want to know, why is it taking some English? Last, if I'm not sure it's.
Yes, closer to you.
Yeah. It does.
I sometimes talk about maybe something amnesia, like deliberating from this generation, but I really do think we should come prepared and know that we have to build those connections with civil society,
yeah,
with lawyers, have those friends,
correct,
you know, have people who will,
yeah,
who will watch for our backs.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, yeah, sometimes solidarity.
Yeah. There's a 1984 dinner in Singapore.
So that was London, Singapore, Melbourne, and Johannesburg.
Yeah.
Extracts.
London, yeah.
The website. So this is the 1984 website. It looks a bit funny on here, but. Because there's no. Okay. Weird. So I've put on here the different edits of the four dinners so far, and each dinner was about 3 hours, so I've edited down it to roughly about an hour and a half for each dinner, and I've edited them on SoundCloud, so. You can listen to the whole thing, but I've done them in sections, so you can. They're about, yeah, under 10 minutes each section. So I kind of reworked the conversation so that I clustered and them into sort of themed sections, if you like. So you can listen to bits. But that's that 20-minute extract I did for the launch of the website last year in the November time, and so I did an event at Birkbeck where everyone sat on a long table, banqueting table, and there wasn't any food apart from snacks, and we just listened 20 minutes to that piece. Yeah.
When you set up the dinners, do you mind if I just...
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
When you set up the dinners, does each dinner share a set of themes?
Yeah, so the... there's a menu of questions for the. Let me see if I. Sorry, this is an unusual layout for me. About. Is it about? No, it's in. So I've got a menu of questions for each. Which is the same for each dinner.
Yeah.
I don't know why this is for, I guess because it's in a different, there we go, there's the menu. So, and that roughly frames the conversation. Everyone gets the menu beforehand, and so they know what sort of questions to expect, but I facilitate it, but quite lightly. So we don't go through it methodically, but I just make sure by the end, you know, we're roughly keeping vaguely on track. And I've realised, importantly, what I need to make sure happens is about half an hour before we finish, we get on to the parallel, the last question, the parallels with today. So as long as I realise, because that does ignite a whole other energy in the conversation, and it's a really, I've realised it's a really important part of the conversation, which I enjoy as well, and it kind of rips it away from the nostalgia traps, perhaps,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
And every dinner as well, just to say, is co-hosted. So the only way it can work is that there's someone else as excited as I am about this period and intrigued as well, and it's sort of relevant to their own work that we then kind of can collaborate on the dinner. So in Singapore, it was a friend of a friend called Terence Chong, who works in the university there, and he'd written a lot about the Third Stage Theatre Group. One of the women speaking was arrested in 1987 for the political theatre that she was making, And he'd kind of written about their work and interviewed them. So that was our sort of link into that. So each place, that's how, apart from Johannesburg, which I had a couple of people I spoke to, but I had to kind of do more of the legwork and getting people around the table. But it was, again, only possible because it was like people contacting, people I contacted, and then they were like, oh, you should talk to so-and-so, you should talk to so-and-so, because it's quite a lot of word of mouth.
Thank you.
And it's a self-funded project at the moment. I work full-time at Birkbeck, so I've got a salary through that. And I really... This project began after I finished my PhD. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in the early 80s, so I did the 1984 dinner in London first, as a mainly because I wanted to bring people... But I didn't want to do one-to-one interviews. I thought I'll bring people together around a table to see what they have to say, and I audio-recorded it, and then last year, when was that? 2014, I was on sabbatical and lucky enough to travel, had a trip to Australia. So I thought, how can I revisit, kind of carry on this 1984 project and make the most of the fact that I'm going to the other side of the world? So I'll try and go en route to Singapore, the plane does stop there anyway. And on the way back, I'll go to Johannesburg, which obviously is not really on the way back, but I managed to get, but there's a little fund at Birkbeck for academics to apply to if they're doing conferences abroad. Mm-hmm. So I applied for that and I got some contribution to my flight. So that made it financially viable for me to do it. But it does, and then I put like £200 roughly into each dinner to pay for the dinner. And if it's a freelancer helping me, then I'll pay them their expenses and their cost for them to help me. But it's, at the moment, I quite like that it's self-organised, but I'm aware that affects the kind of... Well, it happens as and when I get to travel somewhere, or it's not a very structured project, really. It's quite organic. It's structured in itself, but it's not in terms of... where I go and where the dinner happens, if that makes sense.
It interestingly circumvents what I was hearing in some of the commentary, that you can start out with these radical ideas, but then there's a certain point where power, you can't identify where the power is coming from. And by implication, I think in some of the discussion around community arts, it's the problem of public funding and power that, in fact, you're subverting that by self-funding.
Yeah.
But what's the constraint then for you on that?
For not having funding?
Yeah. Well, obviously.
You've got a lot more of it than you would be otherwise. I think the fact that I can't pay people to come to the dinners, I mean, that's always we feed people, but we're also, you know, they're coming in their free time. Does that limit who can come? The generosity of the dinner is quite manipulative. I quite like that as well, that the dinner is it's quite a manipulative space of getting people drunk, potentially, or at least supplying some wine on the table. Not necessarily everyone drinks or has to drink. It's not a requirement of the invitation. But you know, I'm encouraging them to speak as openly as possible about this and ask each other questions. And the dinner helps, that convivial space of eating helps to break some of that down and encourage that. And everyone gets ethics forms, and I before editing it, it's in the consent form and information sheets that I give people, they have, I tell them that, you know, I won't go public with this unless they're happy with the edit. And they get a chance to remove remove themselves or their certain words and or names. But I also sort of encourage them not to, in the name of not self-censoring the conversations. But everyone got the edits before I went online. But no one's come back to me saying they didn't like what they were saying. There was one case with the London group. I had to change the name of some, or not change, I just kind of blurred out in audio, in an audio way, mashed up, whatever, you know, that's one of the names, which because it was quite a personal dig. Yeah.
So I have a question about that. So if you're doing that in a sort of, are you doing that in a freelance capacity, Sophie Hope, the artist, or as an employee?
I basically say everything's my practice-based research.
Okay, so my question's around the ethics form and who's that between?
Between me and the dinner guests.
All right. So it's not from Birkbeck.
No. Well, I mean, I did do an ethics form that I've shown my head of department. He's got copies of that and didn't seem to think it was a problem.
Yeah. So just like feedback
on
it.
It's me just making sure I'm covering my bases and a good way. Mm. I suppose for me it kind of helps with the communication aspect as well, just keeping a track of who's been involved and if they have any questions or, you know, things they want to discuss with me, they've got the information there that they need.
Yeah.
And they know up front where this is going, that it will end up online, an edited version will end up online and things like that.
I suppose I'm just pushing a little bit in, because ethics forms are a bit like insurance, aren't they? That they're great, they're kind of quite informal contracts, but actually if something goes wrong, it's like insurance. It's like, you know, who is actually the argument between? And so
yeah, it's a good point.
It's connected to a university. Yeah.
Who's covering their back?
It's interesting, you know, if one is carrying on research outside of institutions or the way you've positioned this.
I think the one that might be contentious is Singapore, because they have an authoritarian regime still where there's no freedom of speech. Mm. And there were, I can't remember if I think I did keep it in, there was the bits when they're joking about the sex life of politicians and things. And we talk a lot about, censorship is one of the big things we're talking about, of course, but they didn't want to censor that. They were like adamant that that's the point of what they were talking about, is this ridiculous situation. So, but I think if there were cases where I was going in, you know, if we did dinners in places that had even more of a strict lockdown on freedom of speech, then those sorts of the ethics of that become heightened. And does the government then sue Birkbeck? I don't know.
Yeah.
Do we just take it down? I'd self-censor. I mean, that could open up a whole other category.
And also over time, if someone changes their mind. That's interesting. Mm.
And a practical question, how do you manage, how many people are there, or are many conversations having at the same time, or only one?
No, that's a good question. I've maximum 10, and which is the idea, because the idea is that we all have one, the group have one discussion together. Okay. For the sake of the audio. Yeah. We've had, in Johannesburg, it ended up being 12 people, which was quite a lot. The other issue I have, which I'd be good to get some thoughts on, because the next I'm hoping to go to Uruguay in September and possibly do one in Lisbon next year, and there's loads, like, basically when I meet somebody they're like, oh, can we try and do one, or it becomes another chance to do another dinner, but what I'm keen to do is not impose the English language on the dinner. So in Lisbon it will be in Portuguese, Uruguay would be Spanish, and I want to encourage that, but it also raises lots of questions around how, just sort of practical things about do I need to be there then? What's my role in terms of, because I won't be able to understand the conversation, but I feel like somebody needs to facilitate it with that set of questions, and just to make sure it doesn't go completely off track, although I like the fact that it does evolve, you know, does go slightly all over the place. And then there's the issue of editing. So if I'd have to, there's the financial implications, because I'd have to work with a translator. I can't quite get my head, because the editing is I really like, even though it's a painful long process, I really like the editing as a period of analysis and filtering and really being with the material, listening really carefully to the material and then turning it into something else. That's the prep that I really enjoy as well. So I kind of selfishly don't want to hand that completely over to someone else, because I think that's the bit I enjoy. So I'd have to sit with a translator, or I can't quite work out. I mean,
isn't there some software that you could,
it's terrible.
Is it terrible?
The translation?
If you're talking about the weather or something, it's fine.
Okay.
If you're talking about anything complicated, well, you end up having to edit it.
Yeah.
You're probably better to get a fluent speaker to speak it, to make an audio tape in English. because there are people that do that. People who do continuous translation.
Mm. Oh, that's, that could be good.
So you could make a parallel English audio tape.
And also I like the fact that then potentially you've got dinners in different languages on the website, or when we come to edit a compilation, you know, like playing with these different layers of translation, because what I got really interested in was with the dinners is, yes, it's interesting, it happened in 1984 and around that period in these different places, that's really, that's the kind of main draw, but I became as interested in the, how do we create narratives of recent times and places that are mixtures of memory, fiction, new narratives, things that contradict each other, that there's a sort of the mistranslation of memory and that and the collective production of memory in those instances around the table. So that's become as interesting to me, that memory studies aspect of it, as well as the historical, there's something we didn't know about that period because of the people around the table talking about it.
So the 1984, is that Orwell?
No, so I relish in the fact that it's not a project about George Orwell's 1984. Yeah. He is Spectre-like, because I really do like that book. It's one of my favourite books. Yeah. But and especially obviously it becomes really, it's sort of become more in the foreground when you listen to the Singapore one, because it seems very relevant in terms of that.
Or when you read the papers about some of what we've done since 9/11, scarily.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is. I think I haven't written a piece gone through, which I perhaps need to do, the kind of reasons why it's not a project about, but it's informed by or the ideas of 1984 are kind of trickling in. But the main influence was I wanted to choose one year, so I chose a year, in the 80s, I wanted to choose a year between 81 and 86, because that was the year, that's when the GLC was a socialist campaign organisation under Ken Livingstone. And
the GLC in London.
Yes, the Greater London Council, which was the Metropolitan Council. So I wanted to choose
a wonderful organisation to work for as a teacher.
Yeah, no, worked for it for 15 years.
Fantastic. And they were putting into place anti-racism, sexism policies way before equal opportunities, way, way before other people across the country. I don't know about the rest of the world, but we were way ahead of our time.
It's amazing, and I got so excited about that kind of. It felt looking back at those periods. You know, I didn't only went back to the sort of early 60s, looking at histories of cultural policy, and that was an exciting time, which is why I wanted to revisit it, because of the. It felt like a blip in the system, in terms of the alliance between artists and politicians for a bigger shift in how things are run, but also the overtly. The overt way that political projects were being funded through anti-racism, feminist projects, gender projects, the whole like Docklands community poster project, the whole alternative people's plan against the Docklands was supported by the GLC. So really anti-Thatcher,
Thatcher, and of course most of the newspapers very anti what was going on. Mm. There's a lot of criticism, it was excellent.
It was all that Red Ken stuff, but the gay rights and the anti-sexism was 10, 15 years later, it was mainstream.
It's all mainstream now.
He was ridiculed.
And now we've got Blue Boris.
Yeah.
But you had, at that time, you had Thatcher on in the Houses of Parliament, you had Ken Livingstone on the other side in City Hall. So across the Thames, you had this almost daily war. Well, face-off and barrage of stuff in both directions for a while.
And we just got ridiculed the whole time in the Daily Mirror for what we were doing.
Like Mail,
green sheep instead of bar black sheep. You know, it was just ridiculous things going on. It was so petty.
What did you do there? What was your role at the...
Well, I was a deputy head in Earlsfield, a junior school, trying to put into practice these new policies. And it was very, very difficult, because you'd have, like, probably three-quarters of the staff supporting these ideas, but the rest were really anti. Mm. Saying, you're not calling me a racist, I'm not a racist. It was really, very difficult to And I had a head who wasn't very strong, so I was the one really pushing stuff through, and that wasn't easy. And then I became the head of the infant school below, and I was responsible for the intake of the children, and we had a lot of immigrants coming in and joining the neighbourhood, and we had to put people who had recently come in to the area first on the list. And so I got people coming to my door saying, well, you know, I've lived in this area forever and you're not letting my son in to the nursery. What's going on? And I said, well, give me some reason why I can let him in, because I have this point system, and if you're an immigrant, then you're at the top of the list. If you are disabled in some way or you're out of work, you're at the top of the list. She said, well, my husband's been out of work for years. I said, well, you haven't... There's a pride, you know, that they didn't want to say that he'd been out of work. But immediately she said that, I was able to put the child on the list to come into the nursery. Mm. That was a very interesting time for me. Hard to do that.
Mm. Do you feel like those sorts of policies were supported?
By who?
By the GLC or by the
They were supported by the GLC, but
did you get support to implement the policies, or
no.
Were you just given them?
No.
Were you part of the process of
coming
up with
no support whatsoever?
Yeah.
From my local authority, none.
Mm. Just told that's what.
Just told this is what you have to do. This is what you have to implement. And I was actually only acting head, and the head who was put in later was a black woman, and. She really struggled because it just wasn't the support.
Yeah.
You also needed something maybe better articulated in the community, because it needs to be a broader discussion. Otherwise, the people who have been there for generations do feel very, very angry. And if you haven't got a support system to talk them through the anger, you can't just rationalise it away, because from their perspective, it's grossly unfair.
So you go from one way of operating to another without... necessarily negotiating.
Without negotiating the conversation.
And so a lot of the white indigenous people who lived in Elsfield, they left. They just moved out.
Did they?
Yeah. In disgust at the way they were being treated. They felt like second-class citizens suddenly.
But you've created some of the situation, which is why UKIP gets such a lot of support now, because some of these things weren't well-intentioned, but not well-implemented.
No.
And the coalface, the... GLC, they took decisions at the top, but then actually the coalface of implementing is at two or three levels down by people who are struggling to serve the whole community.
Yeah. I was kind of 30 or 28 or 29 or something.
I was stressed out.
I was completely
very,
stressed
very
out.
Stressful.
Yeah. Actually, if I'd been in Islington, I'd have got more support. Elsfield was a very, very poor support system. But I moved back to Islington as a deputy there, and it was much better. So the support system is very important when you're trying to implement any new policies.
Well, it's even more embedded in that, in the sense, the development of the policies. We haven't missed you out, honestly.
This was your piece.
Oh, yeah, I've got loads of stuff here. Does anyone want some of this?
That's yours.
Right. That's your piece. It kind of went round this way.
That's brilliant. I was just mouthed.
So although I actually believed in these policies and I really pro them, I found it very, very difficult to put them into practice because... As you say, there wasn't the groundswell of support from people around.
Yeah.
There's an interesting remark, I don't know if it's in the Joburg discussion, where one woman says, we came with all these ideas, but we didn't communicate them.
We didn't share them.
Well, they didn't share them with each other, even.
Right at the beginning.
I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. So that you can have this sort of... this radical thought and this radical activity, but unless it impacts a lot on the what's happened with the connected communities research in the HRC, that I've always been a little bit ambivalent. I mean, at the time that Helen's PhD got funded as part of connected communities,
that was the first
was
round,
the first
wasn't it?
Round 5 years ago is when we first applied. And the agenda for connected communities, it's a strand of funding within the national funding. It was very much predicated on the idea of the big society. I mean, almost embarrassingly so now. When you read the guidelines, it's like social engineering and really deeply problematic. But recently, Kerry Facer, one of the leadership people, has been in Manchester and up here in Aberdeen, and she said the reality of the actual projects is interesting, and for her, kind of the source potentially of a kind of minor revolution, particularly in relationship to the role of the universities, because it's having to have that conversation across different agendas, different interests, different communities. And, you know, really, particularly for universities, can begin to challenge the idea of the university as this sort of specialist silo that incidentally negotiates with its constituency or its, you know, that actually it now the university has become, it's a relational model that the university in many ways needs to almost not exactly serve public interest, but there's a real unpacking or unwinding of a conventional siloed idea. Mm. I mean, Birkbeck, of course, there's always been... No.
I might have been.
It's had a good external image of being radical.
Yes, it continues to present that image.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
Very...
In a hypocritical way.
In a hypocritical way.
Yeah.
Wants to be like every other university.
Well, somebody also made a comment on amongst those interviews about dissent becoming a style.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which session that was from, but
that was Singapore.
Is that Singapore? Mm.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite an interesting comment. That institutionalization of a mode that at a particular moment of time can create change and is sort of dangerous to authority, but then has those edges smoothed out from it.
And I think that I find that, you know, it's also a question about one's research as well, like how is it relevant and active and not just about art and politics, but it is art and politics at the same time, is a kind of action research or militant research. Well, you know, and there's so many people I find I get frustrated at university because the majority of people are researching about about politics or about these issues and
as if they were separate from
and you never see them on the picket line, these people, ever. I wonder, I just find that really, I just find it one of really depressed days of me anyway, but I also feel like I also need to keep that in check myself as well as a sort of person within that context as well, how to keep it useful. And the impact agenda on universities, which is a whole other can of worms, but that supposedly has this idea of it being, you know, our work is relevant and has an impact on the wider world. But I've been really vocal against, anti that, and vocally so at university, because I've come out of that New Labour world of doing evaluations of public art projects and socially engaged art projects or regeneration in art projects. And it's like, you know, 20 years later, universities have cottoned on to the fact that they need to spin positive stories about what they do, and that the research they do creates happier, more successful, employable people. And I'm not interested in telling that story. That's why I went into academia, was because I was fed up in the evaluation business of having to tell happy stories about, or not having to, but how the stories I was telling were being turned into adverts for how amazing the arts are. That's not my interest. So, it personally, you know, I wanted to get away from that instrumentalising critical research and critical forms of evaluation. And that's pretty much now what universities are up to doing. I was like, if you want to do that, hire a PR person. Don't get academics to spin amazing stories about what they're doing, because, to be quite honest, it might be completely useless and really tell not very good stories that you don't want to hear. But anyway, that's my real...
Well, you can't tell the story that doesn't want to be heard.
I think it's harder, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's much harder.
It's about... spin it. It's about spin and and
it's the banality of celebration, isn't it? It's the idea that you can only ever be talking about the success, but you can't actually be talking about what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's happening in academia, is what it's like.
It's what's happening in the media.
And I remember going to, this is slightly different, but going to like a media training session at work. And the and I was like, oh my God, no wonder I'm not in this business. Because they were like, okay, so what's a newsworthy item of your research?
Newsworthy.
Like, actually, you know what I've realised? I don't think any of my research is newsworthy. I don't know if I should be here. But there's some people have, you know, done research on coastal erosion and things like that. So when those things crop up, they're like, the news might contact them and say, give us some facts about coastal erosion. Or your findings from your recent research, but and so there's sort of slightly more tangible things that she could talk about. But then, all the training was about getting the messiness of what we're doing like into a one sentence. I was like, that's stressing me. I like the opposite. I do the opposite. I make one sentence really bloody complicated. That's my job. So I realised I probably shouldn't be called up to speak on the radio. They had some really interesting points about how radio or news works, because, well, you know, in terms of concentration spans, and the language that you use, and, you know, it's interesting.
But it's pressure to produce answers when you feel like your role, it should actually be
more
to
questions.
Questions. Which is the same thing that's happened with instrumentalization of artists, isn't it? You know, that rather than being asked to solve issues rather than problematize issues.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, in relationship to that problematizing, what do you feel that up to this point, what have the dinners given you?
I think
in terms of insight.
One of the questions I have, I'll get to that. A big question I have is where and what to do with these dinners. Mm. Like where's the analysis? Where's the kind of am I data gathering?
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a period where I go, okay, I'll write a book up about it on some of the kind of connections around the content, about the methodology. So I guess that's a question I have, and I haven't. Well, it's time, isn't it? As well, like, how do I carve out the time to actually give this some thought? And I worry about just doing more dinners, and then they just be. I mean, it's a kind of archival creating. Process which I enjoy, but I'm also aware, how do I embed a sort of process of synthesis analysis within that, and so I guess the things I'm getting out of it are, yeah, it's an opportunity for me to be nosy, which I think is what what research is often about. I can get to be really nosy and learn about places that I would never get to go to otherwise, or get an opportunity to research. And it's a kind of bit of a lazy way of doing that, because I get people together to tell me about those places. I do a bit of research before I go, but I'm not an expert on any of these places. So it's a kind of, it's a little key into a time and place. Mm-hmm. And it can only ever be a little snapshot. It's not going to be comprehensive or anything. It's very partial. And I like that as well, the partiality of it. And hopefully then I can, and it's about then going, as I say, the sort of editing process, drawing out some of the overlaps, like doing the 20-minute edit. I really enjoyed that process, because it allowed me to draw out some of the connections between these things. Because when my experience of the dinners is that people talk very locally. They're like, what is going on our patch at that time? And like, maybe it's because it was, you know, we're talking pre-internet, easyJet.
Yeah.
Although people travel, people were in Johannesburg, quite a few people around the table weren't in Johannesburg, they were exiled at that time. But nevertheless, I got the sense that people were remembering and focusing on quite local issues, which of course have global implications and connections. But I was saying to someone the other day, I'd love to I would physically like to get everyone together, so who's been a dinner guest so far, but maybe we could do that virtually, because again, resources might be difficult, but to have a virtual re-dinner with people in different places and eat together virtually or through Skype or something, because I think actually then to have a conversation between people and them asking questions of each other in these different contexts would add another sort of layer or
Maybe you could get a couple of people from each dinner or something like that.
Yeah, maybe that's more feasible. Far too ambitious.
The Skype will work. I mean, or teleconferencing.
Yeah.
It would necessitate a lot of contextual.
Well, people could listen to the dinners. They could listen to the dinner these ones and then use that as a sort of starting point. Because that's what I was thinking. I remember years ago when I was working with artists in Southeast Europe, one of the big questions that we had was like, how much do you need to know before you talk to someone? That is a question for research, I think, in general, and making work and curating and all these things. Like, do I need to be an expert in this before I even open my mouth and say something to you or set up a meeting or something? And I think I've realised that maybe it helps having working with the co-hosts in these situations who know a lot more. But I don't know if this is the right way of putting it, but there's almost something in that kind of me being quite ignorant and not naive about the situation, which cracks open a conversation, because I can ask quite obvious questions that they have been so entrenched with. It's like, it provides a bit of an opportunity for them to revisit something that they like wouldn't have done otherwise, and that has come up, like in the dinners. They wouldn't have, like the Singapore one, they'd not sat, even though some people have written about the third stage, they've not really been very, very vocal about that, because it's still such an issue there in terms of censorship. So I don't know where I was going with that, but there, yeah.
I think that's a very important question, actually. I mean, it sort of impacts in a way on the status of the dinners as research and how much analysis you may or may not want to do, whether they're data or whether they're actually... I think last night you said something around how important it was that we grow understanding through an experience. Mm. Was it you? Somebody said that. That we need to experience things, not kind of
not
so much know about them, but live them. Mm.
And we can't... I can't pretend to do... You know, it's hard to do that with history. So there's the sort of being... because I think I could write, like, okay, there's a paper there, isn't, I could do about the methodology, which I would like to do. I feel like that's a good thing is for me to reflect on, and I am interested, as I say, with drawing on that sort of memory studies literature and thinking about how you know, that was something in the PhD as well, like playing around with the idea that there is, that an interview will reveal some kind of truth on the matter. That is a construct which I find fascinating that people still believe in that. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, drawing on that kind of skepticism, feminist situated approach to thinking about the world into the dinner format and the menu and the manipulative sort of aspect of it. There's also something about, I mean, we don't do all these different courses, it's much more fluid than that, but there's also something about the a kind of issue around etiquette and like the class issue of the dinner, like a dinner party. I was like, oh yeah, that dinner party format made sense to me, because I really like going to dinner parties and having people over for dinner. Like, dinner is a thing that I've grown up with, and of course that is quite a middle class thing to be discussing as a kind of norm that then other people enter. So what is this I'm imposing, this kind of structure of the dinner? Like, how are we supposed to behave in that context, especially in working in different parts of the world that don't necessarily eat in the same with the same conditions and customs and things
socially.
Mm-hmm. So I think that all needs to be challenged.
I'm struck by how many of the issues actually are current issues. You know, that business about community art, about artists in relation to politics, about action in relation to politics in general. I mean, I think those are all very, very
and that's
current.
Why I was wanted to do it. I'm like, this is. I feel so frustrated personally with reinventing the wheel, going round in circles.
That's what we do.
That's what we do, isn't it? But I'm thinking, how can I inform myself so as much as possible, so that I can learn from past mistakes, past kind of glory, past like tactics as well, like practical things. They're quite practical questions, like how did you survive? How did you eat? You know, how did you survive? How did you pay your rent? like there's a kind of nitty-grittiness of the decision-making process. Who are your allies? Who are your enemies? And they, or I know it's not so easy as saying that, but you know, the, what were the kind of discussions at the time which were fraught, which were, if you can remember, a lot of people can't, and also people don't remember what they were doing in a specific year. Some people bring their diaries as a prompt or something that they had from that period, and leaflet or something as a prompt, a badge, a t-shirt. That's quite nice that there's sort of these physical prompts.
I can quite see it as a script that develops.
Yeah,
I think you're involved in an analysis through your editing process, because you said turning it into something else, which is but how does that work? What does that actually mean? How does that relate to the meaning of the conversation? So I think that there's a certain analysis going on really naturally through the process of the work.
And I love the idea of pushing it further, fictionalising it further.
Exactly. So I think in relation to the content, that there's a script that is about all the answers to your questions as a dinner.
Mm-mm.
You know, we were talking about Abigail's party last night, or something, you know, Mike Lee-esque of the time. It would be brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's also universal, is not a thing.
Yeah,
it's
very
relevant to now. And okay, maybe the same issues are not so relevant in those particular parts of the world, but they're very relevant in other parts of the world. And I thought also that with the internet, we feel we know a huge amount about what's going on and all over the world. But I feel I knew a lot of what was going on in 1984 about what they were talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
I felt in touch with all of that. It was not a surprise to me. It's not something I've learned later. Okay. I knew it at the time, what was happening. So we didn't have the internet, but we still knew.
Yeah. And I think in 84 there were anti-Botha protests.
Cricket.
Not
Botha,
yeah.
So probably there were too.
Botham's all right. Botha?
Botha was around the same time, probably.
Because he was on his way, invited by Thatcher to visit.
Mandela was still in jail then, was he? I'm trying to remember when Mandela...
Yeah, it was, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a couple of years later.
90.
Was it 90?
I think so.
Yeah. God, it's late as that.
Yeah. I remember going up Benahi with a South African friend.
Yeah.
But for me, there's something really interesting about... what's the difference then between an academic researcher and an artist engaged... I mean, generally, not focusing on this project, and a writer or a director developing a play for the National Theatre or something like that, that is researching this history. There's something really interesting about identifying what the difference is between those two, for me.
And
do you know what I mean?
Because there's people that, I guess, we, you know, Anne and I've spoken about this as well, but the... Mm. As a practice-based researcher in a non-practical university like Birkbeck, a humanities context, but there are only a couple of people who, like, there is a playwright who is on the books, you know, salaried, and does his plays, and that becomes part of the ref.
Hmm.
But there's not really anyone else apart from me doing practice, and how then do you avoid it just being about writing? Peer-reviewed articles, which is essentially still the only thing that counts at Birkbeck, at least for the ref. So I'm trying to work out how can some of this work that falls in the gaps or that isn't always just text based.
Yeah.
Although I actually don't have a problem with. I think I like writing and I like the. I want to do the journal articles, but I also want to find another format that's equally valid and valued. But that's an ongoing, isn't it, situation, I suppose. But I think that sometimes there are different... like, you know, the question for practitioners as well as where's the research?
Yeah.
You know, often we ask where is the practice, but also where's the research? And not everything should be research or should have to define where that research is. I think loads of artists do research, but is it... when it comes in, it comes to kind of an academic context, I suppose, where's the research? I think it's how you frame it, how you articulate it, like in the PhD process, isn't it? It's all about that sort of justifying of
Maybe it's about the role of the participants in that journey through gathering that material and the analysis and then the form that it takes in terms of synthesizing it, which wouldn't happen otherwise.
There's a kind of a danger, I think, in describing the dinners as data gathering towards another end, like another art.
I suppose that's what I mean, yeah, that's
because
that engagement.
Because in a way, it then makes invisible your role in relationship to constructing the situation, constructing the event, you know, curating the event. It's very interesting that working with the anthropologist, Tim Ingold and so on, in the Knowing From Inside project, there's a discussion now where there's a feeling among the anthropologists that it's enough to do what they describe as the good ethnography, which is to construct the situation and describe it, because describe it in a way that carries analysis. Not to go this extra mile of then reflecting on that experience and analysing it to another set of conclusions. And Tim is quite adamant that actually, although he makes a big difference between ethnography and anthropology, anthropology is the discourse, is the meta level of thinking, the philosophical arm of anthropology. And ethnography is the experience of being in the field. And if you treat that experience subjectively, if you understand that your role in a situation is actually always active, then, you know, just creating the ethnography is, for example, sufficient for a PhD. You don't attempt to go beyond that. So it's made me rethink a little bit how we've in a way never been able to do that because of all the... Why haven't we? Because of trying to pitch the practice-led model of research against what actually is a positivist model, which is data gathering, data analysis.
And in a way, then it, you know, you think about the structure of the play or the painting or the audio piece is, you know, it holds within it potentially all of those things. Yes. It doesn't have to be fragmented out. If it does it well, if it's good, then it kind of holds all of that.
So then you would sort of argue, I suppose, the research content on the quality of the questions and issues that have been raised in that structure, the quality of thinking. Because not all plays, not all artworks are research or research focused. They can be. It's important that they're not in many ways. And suddenly you're in a much more nuanced.
What would be an example?
Of not being research.
Yeah.
You're fast.
Of someone trying to figure something out.
Is it new knowledge that makes the difference? If it's not
again, if you accept the artwork or the event as being, you know, new knowledge depends upon some process of analysis that will.
So just a retelling of a story.
I don't know.
But in South Africa, someone like Adolf Fugard, his plays are casting. I mean, I think you could argue that they've got data gathering, analysis, conclusions presented, but they're presented in a way to an audience so that that audience can experience what those people are. You know, remote people in a different place are suffering or, you know, political circumstances or whatever. So in a way,
that's the publication
compared with something like if it's just a farce to make people laugh, there's a skill in playwriting to just write very funny stuff, which arguably doesn't have. I think it's all a spectrum, isn't it? But
I suppose it's like Shakespeare with plays within plays.
Well, you know, kind of Shakespeare is brilliant. Yeah. But, you know, you've got all of the
fantastic researcher.
He's a fantastic researcher. I think, yeah, you'd have to say.
And then he would have the farce.
Apart
within
from
the
it's fantastic, almost anything. But yeah, whereas there's some very clever plays which really don't meet many of those criteria. Probably.
I suppose coming back to this, it strikes me that
participants are hugely creative people with all these sort of different ways of expressing themselves. So you have a massive resource there. Mm. Well, you know, are they motivated to engage in what this might add up to, or what how it might become relevant or timeless? I think
it's something I haven't, again, time. I need to think about how that might happen, what format or framework, because I liked the idea of, you know, having these up there then that people could respond to them and make pieces in, you know, like their own offshoots from the material in a way. So it's a... but again, I'm aware that might need resources for me to be able to commission people to do that or...
I don't know, I'm not trying to solve problems in that. They might, I just think they have their own resources.
They were all enjoying it.
Yeah.
You gave them enjoyment.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of like, if there was a new piece of work that somebody wanted to, if one of the people around the Singapore table wanted to kind of use this as a spark to do some other piece that then could speak to the project or have another, another arm to the project. Like there were some younger playwrights there who would be great, you know, to have, and that would be another excuse for us to continue.
Drop lots of pebbles into making lots and lots of
progress. And I think also I have a, like, probably, I don't know if other people have this, but I kind of get a bit of a FOMO thing. I've got a real FOMO problem, it's an illness. Fear of missing out.
Thank you. I didn't know what that was.
And so I get this sense of being like, I'd love to be. And I think that's also what actually was the reason for the project, because I like the idea of being omnipresent. That's so arrogant, isn't it? Oh my God, I just said that. But you know, like when you have that, you can like be in different places at the same time. Yeah. Like how I remember when I was younger, I'd be like fascinated trying to imagine what is happening in another country, which I don't, you know, even know what language they speak. Or you know, like how can I imagine what was going on at the same time I was having my breakfast as somebody with somebody my age in the other part of
in
the world.
Africa,
like I remember, I remember that being quite a you know thing. I was like, oh God, how do we cope with this? Not knowing. So there was. So I think that's always stayed with me somewhere in my body, like as a quandary. Mm. And then I saw the Night on Earth film.
Yeah.
And I was and that made me. That which was, it's a film, really silly film, like taxi drivers, it's a fictional film, taxi drivers across the world in five cities, and it's there about their night on Earth in these taxis. And I just thought as a device, that's a really lovely sort of way of telling a story. So I basically stole that idea and then, and thought about the 84 thing. So I think that sort of drive to inquire what's happening, but also then with potentially new other commissions. And I think that's where the curatorial kind of character in me comes out, because I'm like, actually, I'd like, it's another excuse to have a conversation with someone, another, you know, it's an excuse to potentially develop an idea with someone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, almost kind of which is possibly problematic in terms of wanting too much control rather than seeing what happens, but yeah, lots of issues.
As Fiona once said to me, letting it go.
Let it go. Which is also fun, and it is out there.
As well as folding sheets.
I don't even know if anyone's really seen it, you know, like who's listened to it, if it's
whether it's an instruction
relevant or interesting.
Came up in Manchester, Graham Jeffrey muttered, Sophie's doing a very good job on the 1984 business.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
so it's leave one hit.
Yeah.
Didn't you measure the hits on it?
I haven't even looked.
Is that be interesting?
Find out. Yeah.
It would be interesting to know if
anyone from around the world is.
Well, if the people that attended them had responded in some way.
Yeah.
Even if it was thinking about that history differently through having had the conversation.
Yeah.
Thinking about
to revisit though.
Thinking about the present differently through having had that conversation. Mm-hmm. Or wanting to do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of whether they got the resources, has it actually evoked the desire?
Yeah. And I think also putting. I mean, it's so much. What can I can push it to a so far, but having I think I've been talking to Further Field about possibly doing something with connecting up the people from the different parts of the world through maybe in a more realistic way of a few people from these different dinners, because that I think putting people in touch who weren't across these different dinners would be, I think that would be a good next step possibly in terms of having that kind of conversation.
another.
It's very fundable, though, isn't it? The project. Yeah, of course.
One of the groups was saying we ought to get together again. I don't know if they did or not. But
yeah. Yeah. And the guy in Johannesburg who was saying, "Why is it taken an English lass?"
Yeah.
A white English lass, I think he probably wanted to say.
Yeah, to get us together.
To get us together. And then other people around the table, I didn't have include it, but they were saying, you know, people do get together. It's not like that's not happening. It just happens in different ways. Mm-hmm. And there's not been that configuration necessarily of people, but of course people get together and they communicate in other ways. But yeah, I think that's sort of something I quite like, you know, like flying in a bit, and which I'm also really critical of that model, but I kind of actually sometimes that sort of flying in and going, how about we have a conversation? They're like, what? Why? But then you convince a few people and then other people come. But in Lisbon, because I was there in Lisbon a few weeks ago at a conference about the 1980s in Portugal, and the which was sadly mostly in Portuguese, so I didn't understand most of it. But the I did a talk about the 1979 event that I did last year, and the I did with another academic called Herbert Pimlott from Canada, but he was really interested in the 80s as well, and he came over visiting Birkbeck, and we organised an event together called 1979 Revisited, using Raymond Williams's Structure of Feeling as a framework to kind of think through how do we access and understand these recent histories. It was really interesting. So I gave a talk about that event, and we were going to do an 84 dinner then, but we're going to postpone it to next year because Lewis, who I was working, I'm working on it with, he was like, he didn't realise how difficult it was going to be. He's Portuguese, but he hadn't quite grasped the ongoing political friction and differences between people that were. Still, some people weren't talking to each other still, which I think is still that's interesting in itself, like how the politics of the dinner table format, like I don't know necessarily who was married then, who isn't married now, or of personal politics, but also political differences, which in Johannesburg, for example, that was interesting, having people around the table who wouldn't have spoken to each other at the time in 84 because they were from different positions. In the apartheid movement, but then and then in Lisbon, he said it's going to be tricky because you've got, ideally you'd love these different people around the table, but they just will not sit down next to each other. But I don't know, maybe there's a way around that. I think because, again, maybe as an outsider I could suggest that in a way that he can't, because he's seen to be one side or the other.
So how did you select participants?
So it's with the hosts, mainly working through long lists of people that they think would be good to have around the table, talking through with them, with who these different people are. And like in Johannesburg, it was really much more of an issue to make sure there was a good, at least half the people around the table were women, because the dominant narrative is a very male voice, a very male ANC voice. About that history, apparently, and you don't have as many women, female voices, black female voices in that. You've got a lot of male dominant. The ANC have the in that ANC there were loads of different. I still can't get my head around it, but loads of different
factions.
Yeah. So, and there's an issue that I think, you know, there's a one sort of story being told, and so it was important to have ANC and black consciousness around the table, having these different approaches and voices. So I think that there's been an issue of, definitely in Johannesburg, that wasn't so much of an issue. So although I'm always keen to make sure there is a gender balance and diverse balance, having Aboriginal voices around the table in Melbourne and...
Do you have an agenda actually for voices beforehand? Almost.
It's through discussion with the host. Yeah, I mean, when I did the first one, I was like, okay, I wanted people who were connected to the GLC in the London one.
So that became a sort of start. They all have starting points. So that was the starting point for London. And then I spoke to a friend who was there in the 80s, and she helped me with long lists. And then I spoke to someone else who was like, oh, here's another group. So I had like listeners and listeners, people. And then it was practicalities, who could we invite, who could turn, who turned up. So there is a, and then the starting point in Johannesburg was this festival they mentioned in 82 in Botswana, that I was really interested in, and it was about the role of art to as a kind of political device to bring down apartheid. So it was very explicitly about that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of criticism of that as well in South Africa and other places around the kind of way that art was being used, but I was really interested in that. And then the starting point in Singapore was the third stage, the theatre group, who were, most of whom were arrested in 87, so they were very active in 84, they started earlier. And Melbourne was the community art question. I that's really interesting, Australia and UK, similar parallel politics and in terms of...
Roughly the same time, actually.
Yeah, so. And they were already, you see, already by 84, Australia and the UK, they're like, community art, bad word. They were both kind of already, they were done with that. They moved on, in a way, not everyone, but, you know, in terms of the word, I think in terms of how, it was mainly because people were frustrated that the politics had been ripped out of it, and it had become professionalised and everything. So there was a sort of similar critique and kind of practices. I mean, I'm not interested in generalising, but there were some interesting parallels that would be interesting to draw out, those histories, parallel histories. But in a way, it became about, because of my bias, it was about the kind of left and the differences within the left, and the conversations people were having among in the left political world. But that's what it became about, I guess, and that became another selection criteria to some extent, I suppose. But of course, it would be fascinating to do dinners with people from different political persuasions, but then it becomes something else, and an even broader conversation, and maybe takes it away from some of the, I don't know. So I think that, I mean, always you're already going to get a spectrum of politics around the table because not everyone agrees. But I think that could be seen as a problem for this project, that it's too biased in my.
So did you have any controversial dialogues in the table? Because I'm from Spain, and in Spain, we always have this sentence that in a dinner you can't talk about politics or religion. No? So for me, it's been interesting to, if you get different opinions.
Oh yes, yeah. I mean, a lot of pretty much every co-host is like, there's going to be fights. You're going to have, like, people are going to be hitting each other. You've got to be really good facilitator, Sophie. I hope you can write me up for this.
Oh God,
what have I done? And then usually it's not that bad. People have become, I think the civilising effect of the bloody dinner doesn't help, but or helps.
But maybe it's because you are talking of the past. Could you make these dinners with current issues?
I mean, in a way, what I'm arguing is that they are current issues. They are those... I got really interested in futurology and time travel as a facilitation technique. So this is another offspin of that, in a way. So it's time travel as it becomes an excuse for having a conversation about today. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're doing, but it's through the guise of and the lens of 30 years ago. Yeah. So I think the that's the sort of motives behind it. Mm-hmm. And all these people are active still, doing. They're alive, they're doing stuff. They may be more disillusioned at this time.
More cynical.
Really cynical and tired, knackered. Yeah, but they are fighters. Oh my God. And what I became so fascinated on was that, where did the idealism go? I was interested in that from the London one, because it was so present that there was this sort of, shit, man, we could have changed stuff. We nearly changed stuff. And then, like, I'm fascinated what happened in towards the end of the 80s. You've got this, again, problematically generalising. But, I'm a child of the Thatcher years. I've grown up trying to undo the damage that brainwashing has done. And I'm trying to understand that through talking to a slightly older generation than I am, I suppose. And there were different generations around the tables. There are people who were teaching, Yeah. In 84, there are people who are students in 84, so there's a sort of intergenerational thing going on. But yeah, in terms of the fights, there were, you know, contradictions being, and contradictions and differences of opinion, certainly, yeah. But I think there's, I want more of that, but I think there is something that happens with the dinner where you're, mm-hmm. either that can spur things or it can kind of pacify mm-hmm. sometimes.
Maybe there's something in the analysis that relates their experience to the policies that were going on, you know, at that other level yeah. in each country
yeah.
or whatever. So that kind of, so this is the reality, but what were those big policy decisions that were changing the GLC mm. into yeah, yeah. or whatever?
Yeah.
There's kind of a strong presence of Big Brother, I think, in well, almost all the conversations, as if...
Yeah.
As if the energy for protest and left yeah. a left political position
is diminished in some way.
Compromised, mm. yeah, it's always...
Mm. I felt that.
That. I found that really curious, particularly in the editor, mm. you know, the...
I wondered if it was because you called it 1984, but in my mind... Big Brother was kind of
looming.
Always looming and closer than's comfortable.
And yeah. and the Singapore one, there's a great there's a real, I mean, there's had so many, everyone, oh my God, I feel so privileged to have sat around in these tables, but the one of the people was saying that they I don't know if it was in the edited bit, but they took their eye off the ball. Mm. So they felt that they were focused too much, it was in that bit, they're focusing too much on the regime in Singapore,
and
they forgot yeah. to fight, that the fight oh, yeah. was actually globalisation and capitalism. And I think yeah. that's interesting, maybe in the thread, one of the threads across all of them, is
the threat,
that there's
the threat was somewhere else.
Yeah. yeah.
But well, we've just had a general election,
yeah.
which is all down in the detail, nearly yeah, all yeah, the coverage exactly. is somewhere yeah, down yeah. at a micro level. Because
yeah.
actually even the NHS ultimately is at a lowish level, and the threat is ecology, the environment,
exactly.
social, our interaction with other human beings. You know, these are the big issues all across Europe, certainly, and they've just not been addressed in the election at all.
It's so true.
To a shocking extent, really, incredible extent. And the media's gone along with it. Even the mainstream media, to an extent, has not really been putting on the front page, hey guys, these are not the issues. They've just put NHS or immigration on the front page.
Why would we expect it to change?
That's true.
Because it's a
general, like that for ages.
It's an election.
Because we ought to learn.
It's the way it is.
Because we ought to learn something. And actually, the ecological threat is bigger than it's ever been.
But does it sell newspapers? So the big issue here is capitalism, really. Yeah. Think,
yes, okay. But so that hasn't been on the front page either, because there's this consensus.
That's why looking at the past in this way is a really interesting way of looking at the present, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about this is that, you know, you have these conversations about things that happened 30 years ago and they feel incredibly current.
Mm. Yes.
And there's all these resonances of the things that were happening at that time and things that are still being played out and worked out, or implications that we're living with because things weren't sorted out in a particular
yeah.
way. And yet, we look at the actions we're trying to take now and we can't see 18 months down the line. Half the time we can't see, you know, 18 days down the line.
But we're not even addressing the right topics.
But we're doing things every day that are still going to have resonance in 30
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. that says something about the extent of responsibility that, that we need to take collectively for political action.
And the collective myopia, just the looking at stuff here when there's a picture that's well within view, which isn't very pleasant, but we just don't choose to...
No, don't choose to do it.
Don't choose to look at it. Too difficult.
I think there's potentially, I mean, it is a capitalist kind of issue, but the generation of people, I mean, I think I've got a sense that the people that were speaking were kind of generation ahead of me, sort of 10 years beyond me. I was just graduating in 1984. And I've got friends who, you know, my experience in a regional area of the UK were working in community arts and film, etc., but on the left. You know, it's the miners' strikes that's going on in the northeast, and I set up a workers' cooperative with mates from uni, that sort of thing. But I think what might be universal is that people get to a point. This is my point.
where they actually they start having children and responsibilities and mortgages and rents and staying in a place because their kids need to go to school.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just the realities of life. And also the 80s going into the 90s where we were on a trajectory of more, of wanting more, you know, of a time, I think, of expectations that you have a mortgage rather than a rent, possibly in this country, or that you know you have a new sofa rather than one from a you know a second-hand shop or whatever. That the baby boomers, I think they are changed in relation to society generally, and maybe I've heard friends talking about losing that edge, losing that focus, becoming more short-term
and more consumerist. Because I think what's become more absolutely prevalent now.
Yeah.
Is consumption, and that's my rationalisation after a long night.
I really agree with you.
Is that people have just voted.
Yeah.
When it comes down to it, what people care about is, are they going to be able to buy as much stuff next year, tomorrow, as last year? It's that simple.
We've just had an indication of the country that we live in.
And ultimately, people have decided they'll vote Tory, because however much they dislike it, because I think a lot of people don't like Cameron. I mean, nobody can like Cameron. but ultimately, they're just thinking, I'm going to be able to buy more stuff with these cretins than with the other lot.
I think they're quite happy for him to be the accountant of the country, you know. Well,
but it's grim if that's our level.
When you go to John Yearling's work in a Nottingham, what do you call it?
Nottingham Contemporary.
He showed in Nottingham Contemporary, but he also went into the, what do you call the whole collection of shops?
The shopping mall. The
shopping mall.
Yeah.
And started to. Sorry.
What world do you live in?
Another world. Parallel world.
The non-consumerist part of the world.
What do you call it?
Shop.
High Street.
She went to the consumerist part of the world and asked people what their
priorities were.
And
it's a good bit.
Almost. To the person that came out about family,
relationships,
health,
relationships,
love, you know, it wasn't the...
Shopping wasn't was on the list, but lower down.
Yeah, that's because that's what people think they ought to answer when somebody's asking them the question about what their family
possibly.
Is.
Yeah. Can't possibly say shopping first.
Yeah.
About it, it's our fault, so I'm trying to fix that.
Well, actually, interestingly, the research says the new the generation was born after 2000 are not interested in owning things, but they are interested in doing
things. I think that's right,
So, like, owning CD is not... doesn't mean anything anymore. You just listen to. You know, listening is interesting.
The experience.
Yeah, the experience.
Our children are like that. They're mid-20s. They're not interested in stuff, actually.
Yeah.
No. Which is great.
Yeah, it could be...
Mm. So it's swinging, hopefully it's swinging back.
Yeah, eventually.
Apart from smartphones and iPads, probably.
Yeah, but you need the technology.
So, and all the invisible labour that goes into that, exploitative.
In Fox, invisible labour, or whatever it is. Yeah. In China,
The experience still, buying the experience still means someone's doing some shitty work somewhere.
Yeah.
And that so underpins the whole notion of creating cultural industries, that idea that there is still a kind of industrial model at work around production and consumption, and the need to produce more than, in a way, to me, I just wonder whether when in the recordings when people are talking about trying to challenge and finding that the thing that they're challenging isn't the thing that they should be challenging. That's me, really, and it's really interesting and very haunting in the recordings. Yeah, and what is that? What do you feel that is? What?
Well, I think it's capitalism.
It is capitalism.
I think it's a force that's in. It's omnipresent. It's a kind of relatively invisible, but everywhere. Thing that's hard to, but which is interesting, I think, about certainly in London, like the impression I got from the dinner in London
The Dinner in Johannesburg, a lot of and Singapore and Melbourne actually was that in 84 there was an obvious enemy, political enemy, the in physical form, who was prime minister of all. You know, essentially
you
got a power figure who you were like, oh, that's the enemy, that's the problem right there. But actually, by embodying that, it kind of maybe that was also part of the issue, because it became about attacking that person and what they represented, rather than, you know, this sort of global systemic thing. I don't know.
I think
it's probably
people
a mixture
did at
of
the
things.
Time, though. I think people did at the time, which is what people aren't doing now. And I think a lot of the criticisms of Thatcherism were saying this will be the result, and the result has happened, and that's not happening now. Nobody's saying if we do this, that will be the result.
But
I think that's the difference.
Yeah,
isn't that
because
we've never predicted that the Labour Party, Tony Blair, actually moved the political, the whole political structure across to the right. And Miliband's just paid the price for that, in one sense.
But isn't the problem that actually the enemy is our own greed?
Yeah.
So it all comes down to us.
The enemy within,
The enemy within is the greed that we have. And the political party that's just been elected in is saying,
you
have a right to be greedy. We want you to be greedy. We want you to increase capitalism. We want this.
Although even if we have an ideal, so we're schizophrenic because we don't like Osborne, Cameron, but when it comes down to it, we kind of don't want to risk the other stuff that we might lose, that we now take for granted. Can't do without the mobile phone, the iPad.
But because I think, yes, it would be easy to internalise and make the subject of guilt, the feeling, you know, a sense of greed, but is there not another force, which is the absence of a discourse, the absence of an ability or the opportunity to imagine an alternative or to experience an alternative.
And that takes a good leader. I mean, I've been very aware of Hitler and Maggie Thatcher in these discussions and the power of those two characters, how they led whole movement in one direction and another direction. Maggie Thatcher actually thinks there's no such thing as community. Just incredibly powerful woman.
And individual rights, she was such a pioneer of individual rights. And we forgot, you know, that may have been, one may or may not agree with that, but one forgot there are community rights. And in any kind of society, there's got to be some kind of balance between individual.
But one
and
of the
collective.
Things in the dinner in London that was so, it's really depressing listening to the whole thing, because they, in a way, good in, like, in a good way, but there was this sort of revelation, well, not even revelation because they knew this, but they were talking about how, while they were so, again, they had their blinkers on to some extent because they were working towards a particular thing, they hadn't realised, this is how they sort of talked about it, they hadn't realised that all those Tories were watching them. Big Brother style, and learning from what they were doing, and then surprise, surprise, 30 years later, you've got it spun around and reanimated, rebranded as the big society, and it said they were like talking about how that made them so appalled and so sick that they were so busy with doing the thing that they hadn't quite acknowledged the capacity of the Conservatives to. Do what they were doing, and in a way that is, I mean, it's like I read it as quite a kind of that Big Brother evil kind of way. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it's sort of almost that surveillance style of let's see what they're up to. There might be something in this. So we'll take a bit of that. We'll take a bit of that,
it's
and we'll
absorbing
read.
The energy.
Yeah,
that's an incredibly difficult.
It's horrible.
I mean, it's happening in this university. You absorb, you demonize, but you absorb the energy.
And then you
and rename it or repurpose it.
And the thing in the Singapore thing, goes back to the what was it? You know, the idea of being co-opted, that the dissent becomes a style. The thing in Singapore, and it just always it struck me when they said it, and I keep thinking about it. Is this up until 87, people basically got arrested and thrown into jail for being dissent. Supposedly carrying out some sort of dissent through their practice. Forum theatre was banned, de facto banned. until the 90s, or into the 90s. But now, rather than arrest people, they fund them. I'm just like, oh my God, you're right, shit. Yeah. That's kind of, that repressive tolerance, that's a Marcuse thing from the 60s, but I think it's really relevant still. Like, you don't worry about them, just fund them. That'll kill them off. Keep them in their place, and we know who the enemy. Who the troublemakers
sort
are.
Sort of Marie Antoinette, isn't it? Give them cake.
Yeah.
Or that revolutions don't happen when it's rain.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what they were saying. It's, well, that's a relatively recent thing there, because that they've started to fund the troublemakers. So, yeah.
Well, you fund them for a while, and then you pull the plug, and they disappear without trace. Yeah. That's what happens.
Once they become dependent.
Yeah, they become dependent.
So, but it brings up so many questions about those sort of the economic ecology, or the sort of, you know, like how do we, those questions again, you know, how do we support each other? How do we do what we need to do without being co-opted? I know that's ridiculously naive and idealistic, but there are. And in terms of research, practice, conversations, you know, where's it?
Maybe you need to plan post the collapse. Because you're either going to have an ecological collapse or you're going to have an economic collapse. Well, probably both. Okay. If we don't adjust to manage a transition, there's going to be a collapse. And the only question is when.
Mm.
And maybe that's 5 years away, 10 years away. But it's not 50 years away.
Mm.
Well, parts of Africa are already collapsing.
Well, Europe could collapse if you have another financial crisis, because there isn't the money. We can't print the $1 trillion a second time in Europe. So, you know, it's not a vanishingly small probability, I don't think. Hopefully it's only 10%, but, you know, 1 in 10 chance of the whole system collapsing chaotically is a ridiculously large. Absurd that we've put ourselves in that position. But I think that's where we are. It was 7 years post 2008, having learned almost nothing. We just haven't accepted yet that there's a systemic problem, fundamental systemic problem, whatever your politics.
But isn't there a fear that we're going to be really unhappy when everything collapses? When actually we could be a lot happier.
No, we will be much, much less happy for a while. No, because everyone will be very much poorer. I think.
Yeah, but that may be a good thing.
Well, it may be a good thing.
No, a lot of people couldn't be poorer than they already are.
No, but a lot of the people who are the middle class, as always, some sliver might get away with it. But no, everyone's going to be leveled down to one level, if you like. But that won't be comfortable.
I read too much dystopian fiction, and I worry we're all going to rip each other's hearts out.
I'm afraid history tells you that that's what's quite likely.
Not only once. Fiction.
Yeah.
That beautiful passage in the Harrison's The Goon Cycle, which is this posing the question, I haven't got the exact words, but it's about the question of sea level rise and how do we retreat gracefully.
Mm. Yeah, the idea, so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I remember
so
saying about that.
Imbued with that idea that actually there'll be nothing graceful about it.
Really, really ugly.
Yeah. Well, you've got to be really skillful to retreat gracefully, I think. And you've got to plan.
And it's the planning.
You've got to plan a decade, 2 decades in advance.
And envisioning of what the implications are. And the letting go of this idea that what we can still continue to do is control by setting up, you know, concrete.
Yeah. You can influence for a while, but you can't control any of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's such a remarkable insight. And yet their whole narrative is around optimism.
Mm.
The admittance that it's a hopeless situation.
Mm. So now let's be optimistic.
Optimistic. And that's good. I think that becomes possible in the space of art, not maybe the space of civic planning.
So somehow we need to make it in the space of civic planning. Don't we? Because there maybe is another 10 years left for planning, but there isn't much more than that if we want to make some sort of sensible transition. Harrison's, it was 10, 15 years ago?
The Lagoon Cycle was
Well, 1985. So we've had there's 30 years of potential planning there that we've gifted away. So we've maybe got another 10 or.
I think what you've just said there, Anne, it's hopeless, so now let's be optimistic, mirrors what Nicola Sturgeon is peddling here in Scotland. If it absolutely fits, it's sort of, you know, austerity, we need to, you know, and a lot of economists believe that too, you spend your way out of austerity.
But that's the old model.
I know, but that's what's being peddled.
Oh, it is. It is.
And in practical terms.
I don't mean it in the sense of continue as normal. I think that the proposal that somebody like that, I mean, they're talking about climate
proposing change.
And they're talking about the relationship of the human species to the natural environment.
Actually, the SNP have got, not someone that supports the SNP, but quite a few sensible policies on the ecology, on stop spending money on Trident, because it is absurd to be spending.
Yeah, precisely. I really think that fits what they're saying.
That end of their policy, I think, is perfectly rational.
But it's not putting the whole agenda in the foreground and actually developing the thinking around how to, you know, how to cope. What the, I mean, that when they did actually many years on, I suppose about 5 or 6 years ago, they did a project in Dorset where they did imagined sea level rise in Dorset and imagined the implications right through to you can no longer have private ownership of land. You have to figure out what your population is, what head of population needs in terms of sustenance, and divvy your line up, your land up around the production of predominantly cereal crops. And vertical gardens in high-rise blocks, no longer scattered, and really reduce the number of animals you might keep, because animals are very expensive, particularly beef, very expensive. So it's really doing that very practical calculation around, which really inverts much of the way we currently live. We still think private ownership of land is.
But I'm just thinking, Helen's right. A lot of this is Nicola Sturgeon's agenda. They've just won a massive landslide in Scotland. We should put a proposal to them, because actually fixing, there's an element of every politician who likes the sort of to be the messianic person who can solve the problems of the world. We could try and think up how would you use this sort of practice.
A moment of optimism.
To use the optimism. So accepting the position is pretty desperate, because privately you can persuade quite a lot of people of that. There's a lot of evidence there for that. But so then what would you, how would you, over the next 10, 15 years, change the way, change the political dial, get them to change, invite them, give them the tools to change the political dialogue and the practical conversations. That would be
good idea.
It would be worth doing. But they might even, tiny bit of a budget somewhere, they might even go for that.
I think to approach things in that kind of more optimistic, constructive way is psychologically more effective than
the doomsday is.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the ways in which people tend to respond to untenable situations is to cling on like grim death.
And close your eyes tighter.
Absolutely, you know. Yeah. And I've seen it I've experienced it myself in organisations where you've got, you know, redundancies coming up and stuff, and everyone's kind of like, if I just hold on, it'll be all right. And then it's not, of course. But the psychology of that situation where you feel under attack from all quarters and things are fairly hopeless is to just kind of shrink in and cling to as much as you can retrieve. You know, it's salvage from the present situation. It's not think about what an alternative situation can be and get out there and actually let go of everything that you've currently got. So I think if it's possible to somehow retrieve optimism from the present situation and say, okay, there is an opportunity to think differently, then that is a moment that needs to be taken.
We're trying to develop some things at work, because there's Bert Becker turning 200, I think, in a few years. And there's a lot of spin, again, within the university about how we can tell everyone how amazing Bert Becker is. Mm. And how George Bert Becker would be so proud. And obviously there's a hell of a lot of us in the university, in our little microcosm of the world, going... Oh my God, George Bert Becker will be turning in his grave right now. last thing he's going to be happy with the situation.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, the dominant top-down version of events is, wouldn't he be proud? So, some of us are in the union are like, okay, let's try and do some alternative events that, in a way, similar sort of thing, I suppose, but thinking about other futures or for not just Bert Becker but, you know, the higher education system, so it's a bit more creative and critical of the situation, but not all I think to do it go through we were talking about how that approach might be more interesting as well as engaging rather than just shouting down, you know, the current regime Bert Becker, which is, you know, which will tell its story anyway, because they're the ones with the money and the
PR
means.
Experts.
Yeah. But actually just to kind of create an internal conversation to begin with about some of these alternative approaches. And I'm really interested in the financial structures, like how you countermap those structures of the university that where, because that's often where decisions are made, aren't they, around the sort of
financial...
And they're
probably very opaque, unless you're
different
from
do a bit of digging
university.
Around that and sort of think, okay, if we had... If this is the income, if this is the outgoing, you know, how would we reorganise that? How would we redistribute? My secret plan is to turn Bert Becker into a strictly egalitarian cooperative, but I don't know if I'm going to get my way.
I think big.
But we maybe need to turn Britain into an egalitarian cooperative.
Yeah,
so
I love that.
Why restrict yourself?
Yeah, well, start small then. Start small with the university.
Well, Scotland is a kind of small compared with England. It's a much, much smaller, more possible.
In Japan, after they had that major disaster with the nuclear power plant, I read an article about what it was like to live there in this particular area, and it was just awful. But this woman was saying, it's just amazing, because I now have something, I know I've got what I've got to do. And this was an older woman, and she visited everybody to check
everybody helped
was
each other,
all right,
honestly.
Check they had water, check they had something to eat, and everybody shared everything. So this was going right back to everybody having nothing, but everybody had enough because everybody shared.
Yeah. And they didn't rip each other's hearts out.
And they didn't rip each other's
hearts out. That's the good news,
the
best
thing. Because everybody was talking to each other again. And we have about 35% of old people now suffering from loneliness. It's a very big statistic of old people. And they just need a role. They need to be needed. As John Newling says, you are needed. We need to get the older generation back into feeling needed and wanted. And I
think that the Thatcher, you know, the kind of bombarding of there is no such thing as community...
Mm.
The individualism thing is so ingrained because the capitalist sort of version of society, which is we all are selfish internally.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, we're never to be selfish. Communism will never work because
it's just not true, actually.
And the free market, as if there ever was a free market, actually, doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Never has done.
These like myths
never will
that
do.
are so like normalised. That's not questioned.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think those sorts of stories where that is completely turned on its head or question, you know, the reality in some situation. Of course, people that we don't, that no one is ever going to be predictable probably in terms of how we'll act in certain situations. But to kind of make sure there are stories and narratives that are...
Do you know Mary Midgley's work?
No.
Oh, she's an environmentalist.
Yeah.
She's probably retired, but she was at Newcastle University. But she believes she's optimistic about how humans work collaboratively, and she roots in her own experience of post-Second World War life in Britain, which is really convincing when you
heard her talk about it. When people talk about that time, they thought the society was fantastic.
Yeah,
they had nothing, but they
came together.
They did.
But I suppose the trick is to think about it as, you know, we're fed this narrative that of selfishness, of the atomizing of the individual, And yet there are other narratives, like we've been looking at Hannah Arendt and her idea that, you know, if it was good enough for us to kind of bark at each other, we would, but it's clearly not good enough. So we but these amazing,
so we whine instead.
So we use telephones.
Communication is just an incredible thing, actually, because it's so rich and versatile and precise and so on.
Precise?
In a way, precise. Sometimes,
yes, in a way.
In interpersonal communication, it can be. But also the idea that we only know, we could only ever think about ourselves as individuals. We could only imagine that because of our relationship with other people. You can't. Yeah. It's absolutely dependent upon the relational. Mm. From the outset, there's not such a thing as this.
We inter are.
Yes,
Well, I'm less sure that animals don't do more of that than we think. It's just that they can't articulate it. So I think it's obviously true, but I think we've over-accentuated the difference because we define whether animals are intelligent or not by whether they can do the things we can do, whereas animals do the things they need to do to live their own existences. Mm. And most of them could survive without Tesco's being there for 2 weeks, and very few of us could. So in some way, depending how you put the measure...
Yeah.
Animals and even chickens and things are a lot smarter than us because, you know, they'll get actually the chickens need corn, but pigeons and geese, you know, they get through 365 days of the year with no external support, which we couldn't have. Mm. Maybe in primitive times we might have done, but we've actually strayed a long way away with this kind of illusion. I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, he's not talking versus animals.
No.
I think
it's a paradox.
But I think those are quite powerful, which for me comes back. I mean, John emphasised the temporal aspect of going back in time as a huge formal strength of the work. And I think there's another. It's a shame Caroline isn't here because I'm going to probably get this theoretically wrong, but I'll give it a shot. She's been looking. I think it's at Derrida. Did you tell us?
Archive Fever.
And his idea of hospitality.
It was, she told me about
it.
And the idea that the best guest, the best host, is the person who's experienced being the guest. Which there's something about that that I think is at work within.
Which he relates to kind of his experiences of being an immigrant, isn't it?
Yes.
That's what he writes from.
Being the other is
experiencing
a phenomenal basis on which to open up, I suppose, to a different kind of understanding. Mm.
Which is
and so the dinners and the idea of the dinners going to other places and perhaps other places hosting people. You know, that kind of mix seems to me to very much work with that idea that. If you are already, if the way you think about yourself is of as being almost the insecure, the more displaced, the more questioning does that, then you're predisposed towards listening more. Anyway, I think that's a bit of theory that. It's worth.
Yeah, I'm going to have a look at that.
It's hearing with Caroline.
Yeah. And we've got some of the right policies about getting rid of trucks.
Yeah.
At least I reckon.